when I was a youngster, when I was a teenager, I had a certain sort of form of epilepsy. Anything that I would hear during the day, like certain noises, sometimes would come and play back to me in the middle of the night or some random situation. I'd gone through, you know, a few years as a teenager, not really knowing what this was and thinking I was going a bit mad and stuff like that. But it was actually just the fact that I was having these what's called partial seizures that were occurring in my brain. I've always been fascinated that way, and just the way that we can micro focus on things as well.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to the 58th episode of Mayhem Women in Film. My name is Evita, and I'm a writer, lover of film, and the host of this podcast, which features weekly interviews with women working across the film and TV industry, in front and behind the camera. Now this week, we're coming to you with a very special episode talking all about sound design. And right now you might be like, sound, what's so important about that? But just keep listening, because I will almost guarantee that this conversation between myself and sound artists Zoe Irvine and Hiller Andrews is about to change the way you watch movies. Or listen, really. As always, I want to thank you for listening to our show and supporting us in our journey to amplifying women's voices. You can get in touch with us on Instagram for more content in between episodes, and check out the show notes for any links mentioned throughout. This episode is sponsored by Feminist Trash. Feminist Trash is a community amplifying marginalized women, trans, and non-binary people, creating sustainable, size-inclusive apparel with cheeky phrases sure to trigger even the most conservative of uncles. Be sure to check out feministtrash.com for the latest shirt launches, media drops, and blog posts, and sign up for the email list to receive weekly newsletter to keep you up to date on current global feminist issues. You can use our code WIF20 for 20% off your order. Thank you for joining me wherever you are in the world. Thank you for connecting with us today. Enjoy. All right. First off, do you each just want to introduce yourself to our listeners? Zoe, if you want to go first.
Sure. So my name is Zoe Irvine. I am a sound artist and sound designer based in Edinburgh, Scotland. I am also a sound for film lecturer. I would say that I don't work in industry. So when you approached me and said, oh, we really want to speak to women in industry, and I thought, I know a woman in industry who could complement this beautifully. I'm also very, you know, I'm very focused on what the situation for women in our industry is. I have many female students, but I would say that I work in a freelance basis from my own studio, and I am extremely privileged to be picking and choosing work from a creative perspective, and also with producers who understand that I will work at a different rhythm from, let's say, an audio post house. So I am parent, and so I have a different rhythm of work. My children are older now, so I could take on a full-time situation, but for many years I haven't been in that position. So I work part-time freelance with people who understand my scheduling.
Name is Heather Andrews. I am a little bit different. I worked for 15 years sort of in sound in general, so I've been working in sound since I was 14. So that is back in the 90s. So it's quite, I have to try and remind myself that I've been working that long in it. But professionally, it would have been about 15, 16 years. Could even be 17 years this year. I can't remember. But I was a Foley artist. I've worked not just in film and television, but also in the arts, a bit like Zoe as well. And also in radio, which I think we were one of the last sort of radio teams that did everything in the sort of old school BBC way. And now I've sort of been part of the setup of the sound post department at a company in Glasgow called Blazing Griffin. They also make games, but they produce and direct films as well. So it's quite a unique sort of company to work for, in that they not only make their own films and television programs, but also they have their picture and sound post there. So we only started about a year and a half ago through lockdown as well. So we work on kind of high-end television feature docs and films and things. So yeah, that's me.
Yeah. And let's just get it out of the way. What is sound design? For people who are listening who have absolutely no idea what sound design, what sound mixing is. Heather, do you want to explain, like, in terms of film and TV, what does that entail?
This is a question that pops up quite a lot with colleagues and directors and things. In film and television land, it's all about budget. So really, you know, I find sound design has been a term that's come up in the last 10 years that a lot of people kind of throw out, you know, I'm a sound designer. And I think even for directors and producers are not quite sure sometimes what they're looking for. So someone will come to you and say, I want you to sound design this. And it takes a little while to try and work out what they mean by that. I would say from a dubbing mixer perspective and from a sound design perspective, on a bigger work, I would say that the full team would be the sound designers. So everyone's sound designing, in that you will have someone who's working with dialogue, someone who's working with effects, someone who's mixing all of that together. Or you could have a team of 20 people, if it's a massive film, all working on that together. There may be a sound design supervisor, someone who's got the overall scope of what they're trying to achieve. And ultimately, in terms of a professional sound designer, is something that a lot of people don't think about, is that you are trying to create the soundscape of what the director's audio vision in their head is, which is quite hard, because I think in university and stuff, you know, and I'm the same, we study sound, we watch films, we go to museums and stuff, and it's all, you know, the word immersion and being involved and it being part of the storytelling. But a lot of the actual work is psychology, is trying to work out, someone's been working on a project for 5-10 years, it's all, you know, in their head, and they're trying to explain to you at the very last sort of step of their project completing what they want. So there's that aspect. And then from a sound design perspective of what I would say that I do as a sound designer, someone said to me, oh, as a, you know, when you edit sound effects or you put sound effects together and you put soundscape together, is that design? And, you know, I think it is. You know, if you have a jungle, for instance, you know, you want to make sure that you've got the right location. And if that person's in their jungle, how is that jungle interacting with their psyche? So that's where the sort of sound design elements come in.
Within the educational setting, and I suppose within my working life as well, I'm always trying to get people to think about sound as early as humanly possible. It, you know, film is an audiovisual medium. Cinema is audiovisual, and people kind of do, but you know, more and more there is interest in what sound can bring to filmmaking. It's much more front, you know, center stage than it used to be, I would say. And also what sound can do is more, you know, our listening spaces, our cinemas are amazing. People's home cinemas are also pretty amazing. People have more interest in consuming this than perhaps they used to. But you know, a lot can still be done with mono. I always you know, we kind of go, oh, whiz bang. You know, sound can be in your storytelling with the most minimal of means. You don't have to be on a high budget production.
That sound design or sound is a huge, huge element. And there's a lot of work that goes into it, a lot. I find it to be such a fascinating component of filmmaking, because it is, like, as you guys were saying, absolutely vital to the viewing experience, but also to the storytelling and how we follow the story. Personally, I don't think it was really until 2019 when I professionally got interested in film that I started analyzing them in different ways and breaking down the craft in different ways. And I think that was also the same year, same probably month, that Uncut Gems and Portrait of a Lady on Fire came out, both using sound design in very, like, intense ways for the storytelling, one in a harrowing, anxiety-inducing way, and the other with this kind of breathless delicacy. And that's where I think I personally became really aware of it. But I'm interesting to know about you two's journey into sound, your connection, your relationship with sound. Heather, what is sound to you?
I have a very interesting relationship with sound. I actually... I don't really discuss it much, but I've only been really discussing it more lately. When I was a youngster, when I was a teenager, I had a certain sort of form of epilepsy that, and it's something that's not well discussed, but something I'm personally looking into artistically at the moment, in that anything that I would hear during the day, like certain noises, sometimes would come and play back to me in the middle of the night or some random situation. And I'd gone through, you know, a few years as a teenager, not really knowing what this was and thinking I was going a bit mad and stuff like that. But it was actually just the fact that I was having these what's called partial seizures that were occurring in my brain, where it was, you know, learning a sound, that's what we do. We learn a sound and it can sound like something else or whatever else. So I've always been fascinated that way, and just the way that we can micro focus on things as well. And I got into sound at a very young age, came from a working class background, so we didn't have much money to learn fancy instruments and things. But I remember when people started getting PCs at home, and I was about 12 at the time. We got a PC secondhand, and this guy came and he was setting it up, and he said, there's this program on here called Cakewalk, and you can record more than one instrument on it. So if you want to record your guitar, you can plug it in here. So you plugged it straight into the PC, and then you can then add piano on top of it. And I was like, what? Like, how can you do that? Like, how the hell does that work? And so I started getting interested in that, and at school they knew nothing about it as well. And then I was into music, like a lot of people, I think, start off with. You get into film, but I think a lot of people are into music first of all. And one of my favorite bands at the time was Garbage, and they brought out their album version 2.0, and they had this song Push It on there, and they'd sampled like the Beach Boys and stuff. And I read like this article, because I couldn't get enough of reading up on these people, and they said that they were working with Pro Tools and they'd used 200 tracks just in this one song. And I was like, what? Like, how can you do that? You know? And so I'm putting my headphones on, trying to listen and going, what sound is here? And what have they sampled here and stuff like that? And, you know, I was just amazed by that. And I started getting into all the sort of electronic music that they were doing as well, all the bands that they were influenced by. And there was a whole trip hop movement as well. I then studied music production down in Manchester in a sort of kind of drum and bass electronic place, and learned all that kind of manipulation. So I guess this is where, again, I'm going to waffle a little bit, but where I would say about sound design, like if you're going to be a sound designer, you're going to work in sound for film or television, or even as an artist, one of the bases that I would say is a good thing to look at is synthesis. So when you make sounds from scratch, so particularly electronic stuff, so you might have a signal, just a generic analog signal, how can you make that sound like something else? You know, that's how a synthesizer, how people can make strings sound like strings when they're not strings. And being able to like learn a bit about electronic production music that way, and how you can go and record stuff like Aphex Twin, he was sampling, there's a song called Hammer and Nails, I think, where it's all just made from samples of him hitting a nail with a hammer. And just, you know, things like that. There was a producer interested in film. I loved foreign films. There was just something about French film cinema in particular. You know, I would watch the subtitles. I wouldn't necessarily know what they were saying, but actually that helped, because I would watch it and I would, you know, sometimes turn the subtitles off to work out what was going on, you know. And it's amazing how much you can pick up just from the soundscape. In foreign cinema, what and it's like what you said about Portrait of a Lady on Fire. What I love about it is that compared to, you know, British and American cinema, I think it's changing a little bit now. They're not as scared for silence. Like, I hate the fact that a lot of kind of what we're living in now, they want to just throw in booms and crashes, but very reliant on music to do the storytelling. And I mean, there's some amazing compositions and music that's in film, but I don't think they really pay attention to how they can use other sound or use that together with the soundscape. And I remember Portrait of a Lady on Fire, that was the last film I saw before the first lockdown. And And the whole cinema was completely sold out in Glasgow. Everyone was sat there. They were so quiet. Like, everyone was just engrossed because it was just so quiet in the details and the foley and just the soundscape. And I just remember reading about the director was saying that she wanted it, that she worked out how many steps the actor would take to the other person. And that would tell, you know, by the breath and stuff, what the person was feeling or how intense it was getting and stuff. And you could tell, like, everybody in the cinema was just completely engrossed. And then when the music, when the choral part starts, it's just like, whoa, you know, because she's really thinking about, okay, you know, we'll put in a little bit of music here and there. And she's got a composer that she works with all the time. So her other films are, you know, filled with music as well. But yeah, I think from being exposed to foreign cinema then made me aware of how the sort of musical side of my background could then be used into this sort of soundscape world. And I, as a kid, used to go out and record stuff on these old cassette players as well. I lived in the countryside, there wasn't much to do, so I would go and do that anyway. And but I don't think it was until I finished college at the time that there was a sort of BBC freelance pool that came out. BBC, I got a lot to thank for what they did for myself and also other people that I know up here, because I think in Scotland, you know, it's quite hard to get the training, the in-person training, particularly back then. BBC and STV were sort of the only places that you could train up properly, or it was going to London. And that's where the diversity thing comes in as well, is that I think things are starting to change now up here, but back then, unless you got in one of those facilities, it would be hard, you know, to step up. And I was very lucky to sort of catch the eyes of some of the sound department in radio and television there. And I kind of technically was working full time there near enough. It was back in 2008 when the crash happened. So a lot of jobs went and there wasn't so many job opportunities up here. But that did mean that some of us luckily were able to sort of carve out, you know, a career. Like I said, I sort of was determined not to go to London. You know, I love London. I think it's wonderful, but I think it's kind of a bit classist as well, is that as a young person, if you're going to a city and you don't have a lot of money, and if you're wanting to try and get work experience in like Soho, for instance, and you're going to have to like have, you know, at least 6 months worth of funds behind you before you even contemplate thinking about finding a job. And so what does that say to people from like the rest of the UK or even beyond, sort of setting your fortunes and stuff? And I was always a bit like, no, I'm not going to do that. And so just kind of set up camp up here. So I ended up working in radio drama and the dubbing department and in broadcasting as well. As Zoe will know, I've always been, you know, mega into my foley. And I think even though I'm sort of going away from that more now, it's still very much the heart of my sound design process. And the same with the recordist work as well. So they're the other elements to the synthesis. I think Foley, you can't get anything more than a sound design sort of example there, because you're making a sound from something else to sound like something else and you're adding stuff together. And then field recordist work is going out and recording your own sounds and working out, you know, on location what you want. So instead of relying on libraries all the time, you're out there recording certain birds and all that kind of thing as well. So it's quite geeky. But yeah, and then during lockdown, weirdly, I'd been speaking with the guys at Blazing Griffin, and you know, they were saying they were setting up this new department with a really, really good dubbing mixer called John Cobbin up here. Initially, it was just before lockdown, like literally just before they locked down, that I was speaking to them. And I thought, when the lockdown hit, oh, that's hit, like that's that opportunity gone, like the one opportunity in Glasgow. But we kept in contact, and that they said, you know, we want you on board. We have been so busy. I feel very, very fortunate. It's still kind of dreamlike to think that we're getting to work on some of the stuff that we're working on. And what's exciting as well, as a female as well working up here, it's so, so unique. They used to have a joke that you would have to shoot a dubbing mixer in Scotland to get a job, because everyone's sort of just set. It's exciting for people, you know, kids who are studying, like who are working with Zoe and stuff, to think actually maybe there are some jobs up here, there's some career prospects, and we don't have to move to London.
A recent graduate of mine, she's someone who has worked all the way through uni. You know, she's an independent person, and then was offered kind of runner job. It was so, I found it very, it's like, oh, we're still there. We're still there. That's incredible. She had an amazing portfolio. She's 200 level qualified, which is a industry certification, which, you know, doesn't in itself count for very much, but along with a portfolio of work kind of indicates she's able. After lots of exciting conversations, being essentially kind of courted to some degree, and then what was actually put on the table was something totally unmanageable. You know, unless she was to work another job through the night, how do you do that? So companies like Blaze and Griffin really make me feel like the industry is growing here. And it is growing. It's not just a feeling. It is growing. And Manchester and, you know, lots of other cities that are more manageable for early career people. It's still, I don't know, I was so hoping for her that it would be a decent offer that would allow her to make that shift. I'm not saying like make money, but actually make it possible, like to be able to live like at just a very basic level. It's not like I have to go in up here. No, to be able to manage. And it would have been an amazing opportunity for her, but she wasn't able to take it.
No, there's that huge imbalance when it comes to privilege and opportunities and accessibility.
Yeah. So if you had parents, if she had parents who could pay for her to take the year out, basically, and go and train for free with these amazing people, then fabulous. But if you don't have that, if you're, you know, if you need to work to live, then there's a lot of classist privilege at play. You know, there really is, which just means that you edit out voices right from the start. You edit out possibility right from the start, and you edit out diversity, which makes it an impoverished sector.
If we want to increase diversity across the board, one of the first factors is money and funding, you know, yourself. And even if you're asking people to start out and fund themselves as a freelancer, they're going to have to buy certain forms of equipment. Where is that going to come from?
Yeah, I mean, with Audio Post, you can perhaps do studio hire. If you want to be a location mixer, you're expected to own your lavs, your sound recorder, your boom. You're expected to own all that equipment. And if you don't have it, then you have to be working on productions that are willing to budget differently and hire things. And that's possible, but it's difficult to start with. It really is.
Can I imagine there's also a level of learning how to self-budget, how to price yourself right with all those equipment costs and that. So sorry, you said that, you know, you wouldn't say that you are in the industry. Do you feel that this is one of the core reasons why?
Well, so I'll give a quick my background. So I went through art school, and I went in there as a painter and came out as a sort of audiovisual installation conceptual artist person, and got really into sound. And I worked for a cassette based magazine. So tape is really core to, I think, when I was thinking about like my kind of deep connection with sound. So when I had a tape machine, being able to record things, record voices, record music, I sort of recorded all my favorite music off the radio and kind of put them into mixtapes, that classic thing. But then also recording all sorts of like family or whatever, your environment. I lived in the middle of the countryside, recording sweet little things, but having a sense of sound as a capturable thing. And then my first kind of job in sound was for this tape magazine called Audio Arts. And first thing was to go and interview this amazing American sculptor called Kiki Smith. And I did that thing of over-preparing and wanting to demonstrate how incredibly much I knew about her work and how clever I was. So I asked these awful questions and giggled incessantly. And then I handed this back to the boss of Audio Arts, Bill Furlong, and he kind of listened to it and went, okay, I think I'm going to teach you how to edit. And so he did all his editing on a reel-to-reel tape machine. It's not that it was so long ago, but it was, I mean, he started in the 70s, but he just carried on his reel-to-reel editing practice I joined him in the 90s and worked with that magazine until 2007. So I was with that for a long time and actually moved the magazine into a digital format. He taught me the sound editing. So I'm going like this because you have two, making the sign of having two big reels. What was extraordinary, and these were just voice recordings, was the voice occupied a physical space on the tape. So if I'm cutting out my own giggle or someone's hesitancy or whatever it was, you literally rock that over the playhead backwards and forwards. You use your China graph, put an in point and an out point, cut it out and stick the thing back together. But what you're left with is a piece of tape that is, you know, maybe 8 centimeters long. That is an And that is an And that was kind of like, so I just found it so amazing. And so gradually I would collect these things. So I had ums and ahs and outtakes, lots of outtakes. And also Bill Furlong, whose project this was, he was a sound artist. And I suddenly thought, sound art. I think I'm a sound artist. Oh my God, I found it. I'm a sound artist. I'm not a painter. Hallelujah. I then sort of began that thing of identifying as a sound artist and working with spoken word, and then began to manipulate the sound. But the core of everything I did was kind of spoken word perhaps and field recording. And then discovering that, of course, field recording also was this physical object. And then when I brought things into the computer, being able to manipulate and use field recording as music in its own right. So I got really interested in music concrete and Pierre Schaeffer and the soundscape movement, and look, and just found a home I was really excited with. So I did two things. I set up an audio publishing company. I was very lucky to work with the Scottish Poetry Library, and I became a spoken word sort of publisher for a period of years with Pocketbooks and Alec Finlay, and we produced really beautiful, I think, spoken word voice pieces with different poets. And then I sort of learned about CD mastering. And then I thought, yes, okay, this can also be a job and an employable skill. And at some point in this, I heard Jean-Luc Godard's Nouvelle Vague soundtrack. So it was a film made in the 90s. And Manfred Eicher, who is the director of ECM music label, granted Jean-Luc Godard total access to his back catalogue and said, just use it. And Godard went around and took things. And so it wasn't like working with a composer for this film. And I've actually never seen the film. I've seen bits of it, but I heard the soundtrack. Like, the soundtrack is so extraordinary and so amazing. And there's a sort of story about someone listening to it in the cinema and then saying, this is incredible. And then releasing it as a double CD in its entirety. So it's not sound from the film. It is the sound of the entire film. And it's in French and a bit of Italian or whatever. And at the time of first listening, I really didn't understand any French. I now hallucinate that I understand French, but still don't. When I listened to it, the whole thing was music. The whole thing was amazing. And because it was motivated, these cuts were motivated by picture. They were absolutely incredible. So you'd have a car tire on gravel and a flourish of accordion and a door bang and silence and then a bit of dialogue. It's a way you would never cut sound unless you were motivated by something else. And I heard all this and I just thought, oh my god, sound for picture. It might seem weird that I never managed to watch that film, but somehow it held such magic just as a sound piece that I think I will probably end my life without watching it. And then I said the whole world of sound design for film kind of opened up, and I thought, okay, I want to work in that. And I don't know, came into the sphere of some early career filmmakers and just got super excited. I was so, it's so funny because I didn't have any industry training, I was so brave at that. I think I look back and it takes my breath away in a weird way, like I've spent the years since then dealing with imposter syndrome and kind of learning, shadowing, doing industry training and going on this voyage in parallel with teaching, which I've actually almost always done. So I think academia and teaching is such, for me, such an exciting knowledge quest. But yes, I began from an art perspective. I still make art pieces and experimental broadcasts and think of myself as a sound artist and a sound designer. But when I'm working in film, I'm much more of a cautious person now. You know, I know all about the right levels to hit and making the dialogue sound good, not just kind of going hell for leather into exciting picture sound relations, although I do very much work with exciting picture sound relations.
I still can't get over the fact that, like, clipping those arms and ass, that's incredible. Like, just the imagery from that, yeah.
And now, of course, we look at sound, and that's kind of incredible too. You know, you open up a door of whatever it is, and it will show you a waveform. And that in itself is extraordinary. You look at the energy of that sound and think, wow, there it is, represented. But it's not quite the same as going...
That physicality, yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Wow. Do you have a favourite sound?
Quiet. No, I don't think I have a favourite sound. I think it's very contextual for me. Mm-hmm. I love lots of sound. I really, really adore the sound of, like, cowbells or goat or sheep bells in Europe, in the Pyrenees. Sound at a distance. But that's one thing I really enjoy, is where a sound really illuminates the landscape in an auditory way, and you can hear that reflecting off mountains, or you can hear distance but clarity. I love any sound like that. And I would say that I suppose a sound I might hate, if you take the opposite, is only a sound that I don't want in that particular moment. So that horrible glitch in the dialogue, it'd be very nice not to have it. Oh, I hear a cat.
Yeah, that's my cat.
But you know, some kind of glitch that you don't want is obviously horrible, but that glitch in itself I don't dislike, and I might like somewhere else. I just don't want it there. It's like a weed is a decent plant in the wrong place. So I would say that I try not to have a kind of like dislike relationship with sound. I'm interested in all sound. I just possibly would like to shuffle it around sometimes.
I would say the blackbird. I find the song of the blackbird something that pierces through, you know. And I think as well, it's one of those bird songs that can be used in such a way that it can be, you know, sunny. It can be a sunny day and the sort of springtime sound of it. But also, you know, it's such a quite a sorrowful tune as well, if you're trying to create a sad scene with something that sounds a bit joyful, or we interpret it as joyful. So that's what I find interesting as well, is how human beings, we hear certain sounds and we interpret it as positive or negative, and how you can then start playing about with that and putting it into a scene that is very, as I said, very sad, but you've got some sounds there that are going on outside. So I like to work on that a lot. What's interesting, has been a few things that I've worked on recently where you're like in a quiet room, in a quiet space, and you've just got people breathing, or you've just got, you know, a little bit of dialogue going on between people, and it's like, well, how do you fill that up? How do you fill that scene up? Or someone sat in a car, and then people would just think, oh, you don't hear anything. But actually you do, because you sort of sit there, and after a while you'll hear, you know, someone's dog over the back, and then you might hear the bird, you know, the birds singing behind you. Or when you stick a microphone in, for instance, you hear blooming everything. So I was hearing seagulls going by and, you know, cars going by, and there's my cats causing a scene, and there's techno man upstairs and things like that. And that's how, like, building those sounds up. In terms of sounds, I like really good wood creaks. Like, if I can get some really good, like, my favorite thing to go out and record is wind. But when I say wind, I mean wind passing through things. So anything that's metal, or something that I recorded, which just was really haunting, was up at Isle of Barra, and there was these telephone pylons, and it was like quite a bright day, but the wind was just that sort of, it wasn't too windy that it was blowing on the microphone, but it was blowing right through the wires, and it sounded like a choir singing. So it's things like that as well, you know, you record these instances, and then sometimes you'll be working on something, you think, I want it to sound like this, whatever. And it's like what Zoe was saying as well, is how you use, you know, sounds together. And I love if I'm working with some, you know, a composer, and they're very, like, open to sound design, and they're like, just go for it or whatever, you know. They're not so, like, stuck in their way about this part needs to come in here or whatever. There's something great when you can work with a good composer and play off each other a little bit, and you can use part of their music, you know, merging into your sound design or soundscape, or vice versa. And lots of punctuation as well, and rhythmic sense. And I like to use the natural, but then start, you know, adding a little bit of kind of what is that going on sort of thing. And I worked on a big documentary series recently, and it was all filmed all over the world, and there wasn't much what's called sync sound, so that's location sound. And there was a whole part where it was up in Mongolia, and there was people, like, you know, building their tents and stuff like that, and there was no sound whatsoever. And it's kind of like, right, okay, what does Mongolia sound like? And sometimes I, like, you know, I'm a bit of a geek that way, that I have to work, like, I have to build it to make it sound like that area. I hate listening to something, you go, that's the same, you know, jungle sound or whatever. And, I can't remember who it was, someone told me, they said they were Australian, they said, yeah, when they've got the Amazon jungle, they play this magpie that's actually in the Australian jungle or something. But just trying to get the right winds and trying to just build that sequence up. And then, you know, having, like, there was a sort of a shaman in this scene, and it was sort of casting a you know, it's kind of spell thing going on, and how you can then use, like, the movement, you know, adding the sort of foley parts to that, but then make it kind of ethereal, so it's sort of coming in and out. That's where the design element comes into that. And I mean, 9 times out of 10 you'll present it to somebody and they'll be like, actually, no, can you cut that, I want the music up or whatever, and you're kind of like, oh, you know. But it's part and parcel with that. But also, like, I, over a lockdown, started getting involved in filmmaking myself, and I've got a collaborator friend called Julia Parks, who is a 16mm cinematographer. She sort of makes a moving image documentary, so not in a standard way. She likes to go on location a bit, like what Zoe was saying. She I think that's why her and I get on so well, is that we love talking to people, you know, and their skills and their crafts. And she's very rural as well. She's from Cumbria, so we met on a residency, and during lockdown, I don't know how we ended up having this conversation, but we ended up talking about the Solway Firth, which is a piece of water that splits it's at the border between England and Scotland, and there's these fishermen called half netters there, and how we saw them when we were both kids, you know, and that we didn't realize there was some on the English side and the Scottish side. So during the first lockdown, we were like, how about we try and see if we can film these guys, you know, try and track them down. So we ended up tracking them down. I contacted the Scottish side and she's contacted the English side. And we got talking to these guys, and then we said, can we go out filming? And we did it off the, you know, back off our own backs. We just went down and we went out into the water. And what's interesting as well, again, I love when you get to work on stuff and you come across, like, oh no, I can't do this, you know, limitations, but actually it makes you think better about stuff. And of course, the first limitation is, Julia's got this massive camera that's analog and worth a bloody fortune going out into the water. So I am going to be there with my boom, making sure that she doesn't fall over, or, you know, that she can change her film in the middle of the water, in the middle of the sea. But also, I can't record them as she's filming, because there's that, you know, the noise going on. So any sort of lovely elements, when they were just, you know, having a little chit chat or something, if she was filming and I recorded it, there's just nothing I can really do. I mean, you can clean it up a little bit, but it's not the same. It's just like what Zoe was saying about talking to recorders as well. Like, I was making a sort of mental note. We were out in the water at like 6 o'clock in the morning, and it was such a clear day, and I could hear everything, like all of the birds, like all of the seabirds, and I couldn't record any of it because she was filming all the time. And then every time, you know, when we were out there, they caught a fish at one point, and I was like, I have to get this sound. I know we can replicate it, but I have to get the sound. So I managed to record this fish fluttering in their net and stuff. And what you don't realize as well is that you're actually capturing history, because these guys are the last, probably going to be the last fishermen doing this since the Viking times, because it's dying out. So we ended up basically capturing history, which we didn't realize. And we filmed this in black and white. And what's great as well, working with Julia, she understands sound and I understand picture to some extent. So it was very much a collaboration of, going out, you know, and I was saying, how about we capture this? Like, look at the way that the sun's passing through this. And she'd go, right, okay, yeah, that's spot on. And she would then say to me, how about you capture this sound? And like, for instance, the guys walking down to the water, there was all of this mud and it was just this, you know, sort of thing. And people might say, oh, can you not just replicate that in Foley? And it's like, well, actually, no, if I can record it right at that point, I can just sync that up. Which I did, and it just works perfectly well. I ended up doing some other stuff filming with her as well, and going from that perspective of directing something, producing something, and then you start going, okay, right, now I get why when you're working with a director or a producer that they're so like set in their way and they've got in their mind what that has to sound like, because I've got in my mind what this has to look like, and some poor person's having to work out how the hell, you know, we film this and then edit it together. And like, I would say to anyone coming into the industry to think about, and is what Zoe was saying, get out with your fellow filmmakers if you're at school, like, or you've just got friends who've got a camera with your phone, just going out and working together as a team and even swapping roles at times and just finding out what it's like on the other side of the desk, basically. Because if you are wanting to work, you know, in post-production, or you know, whether you're all going to start a budget, you know, then move to the top, you are essentially working for someone else and you are trying to achieve their vision.
Every bit of knowledge you have about another part of filmmaking is super useful. And so I have two thoughts. One is about communication. So you can be, let's say, a technically amazing sound designer, but impossible to work with. So part of the job, and a big part of the job, is people, is being able to understand, to get into the mindset, to find a common language, to be able to talk to people. You know, not every director is actually able to articulate what they want. And so it's like finding, you know, what you mean by heavy or light or, yeah, whatever the words that people use, is finding out what that means for that person, which is why often when you land up working with someone, you work with them again and again and again, because once you've established some kind of language, it's like, oh, I really want to work with Zoe because she understands what I mean. And therefore, you just cut out a whole load of establishing difficulty or a whole load of back and forth when I've gone off to do work where I've misunderstood what it is that's wanted. And then you come back and they go, look, no, not really. And I've only had one instance in my working life where I haven't managed to establish communication with the director. And it was the most gruesome experience I've ever had. And the weird thing was, I knew her work and I loved her work, but I'd never worked with her before. And she knew my work and liked my work. So it felt like it was going to be a good fit, but we couldn't communicate. And I couldn't understand what she meant. Normally speaking, I can get my head into most aesthetics. You know, you want this kind of thing? I can go there to some degree, at least. In this case, it was just like every instinct I had was the opposite of what she wanted. And in the end, what I did was I invited her into the studio to sit next to me. And I said, look, you know what? I will be the buttons and you just will just inch forwards bit by bit. And in the end, the film, in my opinion, was horrible. And it actually got pulled by the producer. It never saw the light of day. It was the most horrible experience. But one of the things I really love about approaching a film with fresh eyes and ears at the point where it arrives in sound design is you can attend to focus in an exciting way. So let's say you have a group of people and somehow the image is encouraging you to look in the wrong way for whatever reason, or not the wrong way, but somehow we're not attending to the right person. So a little bit of Foley, a little bit of, you hear the gulp or the sniff or the slight movement only of that person, suddenly we're with that person. And it doesn't matter exactly how the framing is. Somehow you can refocus, reposition, reconnect an audience. And it's super exciting to be able to do that. You kind of go, okay, we want to be with this person. Okay, we can do that. We want to stay with this person while we're watching this person talk. We can do that. These kind of sort of narrative pulls. But what you need in order to do this kind of thing is time. And I guess that's part of my campaigning thing, is you sort of go, okay, producers, how much time do you allow for the edit? Please do not think that half that time or quarter of that time is acceptable for post-production sound. If you want to be able to creatively engage with the narrative, with establishing that communication with the director, I mean, you may even have a shorthand, you still need time to do the work. It's a real-time activity. Now, that's for, you know, when you're being able to make a really creative input into something. I've seen someone do edit dialogue without listening. It blew my mind, but it was a very fast, really standard bit of TV, very generic. They'd done the previous five episodes, the previous 5 days. And I was sitting next to this guy kind of going, you what? You actually what? You know, no one really wants that. But that is the result of no time, no money. In fact, he did an amazing job and it was astounding to see. But it's horrific. If you want a bit of dialogue cleaned up, that's a different kettle of fish. If you want storytelling to happen in your sound, that's something else.
That's definitely something I think with the shorts as well that don't have a lot of money naturally. I think a lot of people coming into the industry as well don't really understand how much time is involved in each element. And a lot of the time they'll ask for a sound designer, but they are really meaning they want everything done, you know. Also, sometimes, you know, you are thrown in with people that you wouldn't necessarily normally work with. I used to be very much like, I like to work on my own. Someone give me the scope to do that and then, you know, send it to them or they come and view it and then they give me notes or we discuss it afterwards. I actually really like getting the time to spot sessions with people. So that's when I sit down with the editor. Because sometimes as well with the editor, the offline editor, they will have cut the picture with sound as well. So there might be elements in there that they have added with the director to have some sort of rhythmic structure with sound and the way that each cut lies. So you have to be there's a lot of people that you are thinking about rather than even just the director sometimes, and they might give you notes as well. But I really implore getting a spotting session with a director, producer, whoever's got the call at the end of the day of how it creatively sounds, because as soon as you've got that communication, at least you then know what you're working with. As Zoe said, sometimes there's issues with sound recordist work and it's a bit like you are cleaning a very dirty stained jumper and you're sort of like on the operating table going, okay, you know, before you even think about the design of it, thinking, oh geez, you know, you kind of have to be brave sometimes to turn around and say, I don't think this is working, you know, as an observer, how can I help with that? Last year I worked with an international team, so my way of doing things as well is I like to go in really early, and there was a film that was being filmed in Mexico, and I said, oh, there's not enough like effects and stuff, and it was during lockdown when we didn't have crowds, so they had to have lots of crowds in these scenes, and it was a romantic comedy. We thought, there's only 60 extras and they need to have thousands of people there. How do we record, you know, how the hell are we gonna do that in Glasgow? Like, how many Mexicans are in Glasgow? So it ended up we going, oh no, if we've got opportunity to talk to the sound team, the location sound team in Mexico, we need to do that. So we did, and found out what mics they were using and everything. And then I thought, am I being cheeky? I made a whole spreadsheet of all of like the takes, like looking at the script, like what sort of reactions we needed from crowds, what sort of voices. I asked them as well, like, is there particular voices? Like, they went to some Mayan temples at one point, and there's different, not even accents, like, you know, the Spanish there is very different to what it would be in Mexico City, for instance. And they said it would be really good if we can get that authenticity. So bless the sound recordist. I said to them, you know, if you can hire out an Ambisonics mic over there, if you can record some of the location sound, if you've got the opportunity to, of the crowds, but also of like the streets and things, so we can get a bit of that liveliness, that will be an absolute godsend. And he went out and bought a mic especially for it, bless him, and he recorded all this stuff. So I was getting all of these things in, and there was elements where I've not been to Mexico City, but how can I make this sound like Mexico city, right, tell me, you know, the producers, tell me. Again, in the spotting session, like, they were saying, there's these little carts that go by and they make this kind of doo-doo-doo, you know, sound. Next minute I know I'm on Twitter. What's great is the sound community across the world is amazing. Like, they're all super geeky. If you're looking for certain sound effects and you're like, I can't, where am I going to get these? You can ask somebody, and there'll usually be someone who'll be like, oh, I've got these, and you're swapping all the time. So I spoke to some people over in Mexico who'd worked on Roma. Like I said, you know, they're talking about like police cars and what's Mexico City like, and they were explaining it to me and stuff, and they were saying, right, you need, well, sometimes we use Spanish crowds because there's not even many Mexican recordings of crowds and stuff, so here's the sort of thing that I would suggest you do. And so we, you know, we went back and forth. Like, we had to come back and think about, we don't have Mexican voices. So we literally found Mexican directors in Scotland who we brought in and paid for to come in and do like certain lines. One of the main sort of comedy elements was this car, this Mexican bang old car. And it was all done with the green screen, and it wasn't recorded, you know. So I was like, how, you know, something that we always have a problem with is cars, and where the hell am I going to get this? And I couldn't find many effects recordings anywhere. So geeky me went, okay, there must be like a club or somebody who owns a Beetle that we can get hold of. Lo and behold, someone had the exact model, a Mexican Beetle. So he drove all the way to outside facility, and then we just rigged it with mics and we drove it about like crazy, doing 360s and everything, and recorded the whole thing. It's like Zoe said, you can do things in a kind of cheap, fast way, but if you want to make something more authentic and feel real, you have to think about all the other elements of recording or getting other people to do some of the work for you.
I just want to jump into some listener questions that we got.
Listener questions.
So because, you know, sound is an undervalued part of filmmaking, I think. Now, Emily asked, why can't I hear the dialogue in movies anymore? It is so muddy. Does anyone have an answer?
Is this just Tenet, or is this other things? There are issues to do with people's home setups as well, and how sound is folded down, what it's mixed for, and how it's broadcast. Sometimes that can be an issue. But, and then it's, you know, in Tenet's case, that's a creative choice. But I would say that for the most part, and maybe that's a TV related question, but I would say that for the most part, dialogue is still king. You know, dialogue, when you come to mix a film, intelligibility is your number one thing. Making sure that the dialogue is present and understandable and flows, and you're not jarred from one cut to another cut or one environment to another environment, that is the number one job that you do. So I don't know, Heather, I'm sure you've got reflections on it as well.
Yeah, it's king, basically. There's a few issues, and you see this coming up on the likes of Twitter and stuff all the time, people going on about this situation. There's technical spec for different countries, for different setups. And so you're always having to think of, is this for cinema? Which type of cinema? Is it then going to Netflix? Is it then going to Amazon Prime? What are they using? If it's going to YouTube, right, they're going to compress this, and then it's going to television. So a lot of the time you're doing multi-platform mixes.
Yeah, the deliverable lists are extraordinary. You wouldn't believe it's like a job in itself.
Half of that is like, yeah, it is a job. It is a job in itself. And also, you know, something that we're starting to demand more of now is cinema tests, because you'll find that a lot of the cinemas are not, back in the day when you had a projectionist, you know, you had people who were technically minded of how things should sound, whereas now, because everything's done sort of digitally, it's just press a button, there's no checks. You know, sometimes the level, the Dolby level that they've got on is not right, it's too low.
But there's not even a standard. That's no. Also the extraordinary thing. There's a kind of accepted, what is it, Dolby 5 or
yeah,
something.
But
that's not even necessarily carried out. So you have no understanding. Like, you're better off mixing for TV. You have more of a sense of how that will go out into the world, although you have no control over anyone's home setup. But you would imagine that your cinema space is a standard space, but it's absolutely not.
The thing that I find as well is, as I was saying, about a lot of directors are obsessed with music. So they've been working with a composer for ages, and you don't get the music usually till very last minute, sometimes when you're in the middle of mixing. Sometimes even when you've mixed the thing, there'll be other cues coming in. And music is really important. You know, people use it as an emotional drive, but I think it's also a bit of a crutch. It's a bit of a safety net, and there's no breathing space. And the way that some of the new technical standards work as well with loudness is that it sort of levels out, you know, the levels depending on what the previous levels were before that. So if you've got this massive crescendo like of music going, and then it dips to this person talking where it's all very quiet and whispery, it's kind of trying to find a way of finding a happy medium of that. A lot it is this kind of fight between that, and also location sound. Was the sound okay? You know, big budget stuff, a lot of the time they don't even, you know, like a lot of it's going to be ADR, so you're having to re-record lines and pop them back in. And then as sometimes the location sound of the way the actors are acting, the, you know, the intelligibility as well and performance. So I mean, ADR, the poor ADR recordist has a big job sometimes. You know, they're having to sort of factor in making calls as to who needs to record, re-record lines, and it's all time and money again, and that's a big money situation. Yeah, it's just a mixture of all of those things. I think the standards thing caused a bit of havoc. I am old enough to remember before loudness, so mixing and broadcasting, and there have been times where I've listened to something, you know, maybe something bigger that I've worked on as an editor or designer, and then I've heard it out on the television after it's been mixed, and I've thought, why is everything so loud? And an issue we were having over lockdown was people were monitoring at home on their speakers and their computer or on headphones and asking for effects to all be turned down because they just wanted the music in the dialogue, but then the music was swamping the dialogue. So I think it's all about, like, loudness was introduced to try and supposedly add dynamics to the mix, but I actually think it's done the opposite a little bit. And we did a project in Atmos recently. I think I can see where the idea of that is going. I think it's still very heavily based on music, but hopefully in like 5 years or something, or down the line, we'll be able to have one format that can be used across the board. Again, people are listening on their headphones a lot of the time now as well. If people can have the ability even just to turn the dialogue up and turn the music down, that's what is going to achieve, I reckon, in the end. I don't think people want to mix their own stuff. I mean, why would you want to sit and watch a film and mix it yourself? But if you've got the ability, you know, with your phone, even if you went to the cinema and you had headphones on, you could just turn things up or change it, and particularly at home. And I think the games world sort of worked on that as well quite a bit. I guess the first thing people are going to think is, oh, they don't know how to mix, they haven't turned up, but there's a lot of factors.
But that kind of ties into what Morgan asks, which is, what is the best at-home speakers to watch movies with? Do you, like, what do you use if you're watching movies at home? Do you have any preferences, or are you just...
That's so funny. I don't have a good home setup at all. But if I really, really wanted to watch a movie with good sound, I'd bring it into my studio and watch it. So I am used and accustomed to hearing things through near field speakers, which sound amazing. I have Genelec speakers, which are wonderful. I think it's such a subjective thing. And whenever anyone ever asks about any piece of kit, actually, you know, what's the best this, what's the best that, it depends very much on that individual. So there are like a ton of different possibilities, and you have to go and find the one that you like the sound of, I would say. It's very difficult to ever recommend. It depends on the room it goes in. It depends on the budget you have. My dad was very into amazing home cinema, and he had surround in his living room really before anyone I could ever imagine. That was his passion, was listening to films in surround in his living room. And I often just hear through the telly, which is absolutely terrible. I mean, I do sit there going, oh God, I hate the sound at home. I hate it. I go to the cinema if I really want to hear something good.
Yeah, I must admit, I'd rather go and see a film in the cinema. I think it must be the only place, actually, if people are being polite, that people aren't on their phones. And it's the only place that you actually gain attention to something that's not your phone as well. I'm quite guilty. I'm a headphone laptop person. If I was going to invest, which if I will in the future, would be probably an Atmos bar or some description. Again, it's to do, I've got a flat with really high ceilings, so it's a bit how it sends sound upwards and then it kind of hits you back down. I would say after working in something that was in Atmos, I really liked that kind of setup. So I guess that'll be what commercially comes out. But again, I would say go to the cinema if you've got the money, you know. And the thing that I love about the cinema as well, but you know why I don't think it'll ever disappear. I went to see Titanic. A couple of months ago, you know, just before Christmas, and I love going to the cinema to feel and see other people's reactions to things. And I knew that film was supposed to be a bit crazy, and there was a bit where there was a bit, and it's again where sound can be so, you know, there's a bit where she smashes her face, and everybody in the crowd, you know, just the sound of her hitting her face off a sink, and everybody just going, someone fainted, someone fell over, there was people being sick, and I'm thinking, oh wow, you know. And again with Portrait of Lady on Fire, when you've got all of these people just almost like they're falling in love as these characters are falling in love, and you can feel the love in the room, you know, if you can go to the cinema, go to the cinema.
So poor Morgan, we're going, I'm so sorry, we're not going to answer your question at all.
Yeah.
We're just going to say go to the cinema.
Yeah.
Go to the cinema. I mean, I saw Titan like 2 weeks ago, and I think there's also just a bit where she like the hairpin in the ear, the worst. I think it was the sound. It's that piercing sound, and the fact, oh God, it was so violent. The sounds were so much more violent than the visuals, which were already pretty graphic. Like, it's insane how much that added to that terrifying experience. And I think half of the audience had left like 20 minutes into the movie already. It was
yes, we that's what I love, you know. Like, it's just how powerful. And there's some really good, there was a really good podcast thing about particular sounds that are only relevant to theater, cinema. So things like underwater, what space sounds like people just want that, or they won't accept, you know, just silence. Or I think it's interesting how in the human psyche socially we've got accustomed to certain sounds and how it makes you feel, and I think that's really important as well. Like, just the kind of organic kind of, I did a thing with like mold growing up a wall and stuff, and just kind of adding that organic kind of glitchy sound, but with proper kind of cracks and pops and stuff. And I think that's why I absolutely love the horror genre. So I'm very into all of that. And as you said, Tanya, and Censor as well, when I went to see that as well. The way that that was cleverly designed with all the screams and things, you know, merging into each other from all the different rooms as well.
No, technology is, yeah, incredible. Mila asks, what do you think about the movie A Quiet Place?
No, I know a lot of people love that film. I actually, from a Foley perspective, I think that's an important one to look at, because again, anything that's super quiet, and I've had something recently that, you know, a couple of projects working on that are super quiet as well, as you can tell, recording in a big room and it you hear every single noise, just what you can work with artistically on that. And in terms of the film, I liked it. It's not something that's like stuck out to me, and but I do appreciate the work that went into it. I don't know what Zoe thinks.
I don't really have anything to add. Sorry.
No. That's I think that's more interesting than anything, because I think a lot of people can associate a quiet place with like innovation, you know. On that note, like, is there any interesting like movies in the past like few years that you've noticed had like very interesting sound design?
Well, The Sound of Metal is one that stands out, and it's obviously incredibly highly acclaimed for it.
Yeah, I like that film for the sound stuff. I didn't like the film, so it kind of clashed with me. There was a lot of hype. Nicholas Becker, I've always had huge respect for anyway. He's a big influence on me because he was a Foley artist before. He still does Foley, but he's very like open, and he's another person who's just loves what he does, and there's no sort of airs and grace. You know, he's just a very humble person. And he did the Foley for Suspiria, and he also did a film, Virgin 2011, Wuthering Heights, which is an amazing sound film. I still refer to that an awful lot, where him and his team went out on location and recorded Foley and sounds and singing even of what the little girl was singing on location. I love sort of a Drive as well. That's one of my go-tos. I love the use of sound, the way that they sound design the car at the beginning, where almost it just disappears, the sounds of it disappear, and it just somehow captures you in, and you're with him, you know, and the sounds of the radio, kind of that very Grand Theft Auto-esque type thing. But the way that the sound and the music just work together, you know, Suspiria as well, as I said, the Foley and the breathe, you know, they use the breath in that and all of those sort of sounds, and they recorded them on tape as well on location. So I really love when they take it to the max, because I think Zoe's probably like, I know Zoe's like me as well, we're quite like, no, we must do, you know, do things like in such a creative to the max way. Oh, I'm trying to think. Portrait of a Lady on Fire, obviously, and something that I was very lucky to appreciate, it's not so much a film, but was Chernobyl. I went on a residency with Chris Watson, who helped record. He was a sound recordist for the musical elements of that, which I don't think he got a lot of credit for. So the composer got, you know, naturally it was her vision, and she came up with the concepts, but she had this really good relationship with Chris. I remember I'd watched it before I went on this residency, and we were staying together for the week. I said to him, okay, nobody's asking you what you did or whatever, you know, but how the hell, you know, it says that you went out and recorded, you know, the sounds and stuff, and she put it all together, and how did that happen? And he went, oh, 1 minute, and he ran up the stairs, and he came down with all these hard drives. Anyway, and these are the actual hard drives with all the sounds on it. So he plugged them in, and he set up the computer, and he started playing these things, and he said, we had 2 days to go into this replica, like, nuclear power station. It's like the only one that's the exact replica of the Chernobyl site. And he said, I had to take my equipment in, but if any of it became radioactive, I had to just leave it. So it was like thousands of pounds worth of microphones. Luckily, it was just the cable he had to leave, but they had 2 days. So they had a day to recce, had a day to look around where they would record and what they would like to do. And then the second day was to actually go in and record the sounds. And so they'd worked out they wanted to use the engine, you know, the main engine room and a couple of other spaces as well. And then what they did was they took in his mics, but also speakers. The composer had some beaters and things as well, and basically they just did lots of sampling from different perspectives, and they like hit the bars, so she was playing rhythms in the bars, and then they were getting the sounds of like the proper like engine, you know, the breathing, you know, like sounds almost like breathing and stuff, and then they were playing, she was singing parts in different levels of the power station, and then he was setting up the microphone, but he would maybe set it up near the wall so he was getting reflections, and then they were playing stuff through speakers, so she might have recorded her cello but wanted to record, you know, have it play in the space and be recorded in the space, so then they were playing her actual takes from the studio through the speakers to then be picked up in the acoustic of the space. You know, people would maybe say Chris is just a sound recordist. No, he's a sound designer. he worked on that. And again, it's that magical element of music versus sound. You know, what is sound design? What is music? Who is the sound designer? Sometimes some composers call themselves sound designers. But then there are sound designers who are essentially composers. And I love when those elements come together, the music concrete elements. Again, it's like finding groups of people who want to work together collaboratively, rather than it being you're this, and you know, that kind of situation, and who's the hierarchy, you know. So that in itself, like, I loved the soundtrack to that, and just finding out how that was all, you know, broken down. And I think a lot of people were influenced by that series.
Well, I don't have recent films. I realize, I don't know. I mean, I've enjoyed recent films like June. I enjoyed in the cinema for the sound design. Two films that I love, they're really quite old now, two Hungarian films, and they're both sound designed by the same sound designer called Zanyi Tamás. The first one is called Huckle, which means hiccup, and it's from 2002, and it's by directed by Georgi Palfi, and it's no dialogue, feature-length film, a murder mystery. It's completely cinematic. It's utterly, utterly amazing. And I've shown it in classes or like bits of it. I've never seen it in the cinema, and I would just love to see it in the cinema. Zanyi Tamás then went, I think that the Hungarian film scene is a fairly small one. He sound designed Son of Saul, which is a much more mainstream film. But again, completely amazing sound design process. So cinematically, visually, we stay on this close-up shot of the main character. We see extremely little of the world around, and it's set in a concentration camp. And visually, we see very little of that. But the world is described in sound. We hear it. And they spent 6 months, I think, more than 6 months in audio post for that film. I would say that those two films are completely masterful and amazing, and at once kind of, they're both sort of quirky films, and you know, they're not normal continuity editing necessarily or normal films. But when you watch it, hopefully you're not kind of sitting there kind of going, yeah, incredibly powerful sound, which actually, do you know what? I sat through June going, incredibly powerful sound. You know,
this has been so insightful, and I have so much respect for everything that you do. And I hope that everyone who's listening, is going to listen to movies in a whole new way now. Now, finally, before we go, we always ask our guests this, but can you each give a shout out to a woman who works in the film or television industry who inspires you?
Oh, I know my person. I would shout out to Jane Tattersall, who has set up, I've forgotten the name of her studio in Toronto, but she has worked in sound for film and TV for an enormously long time. She's mentored a lot of people. She has made an incredible contribution, but she did the sound for The Handmaid's Tale, which was, you know, incredible. And she, I think creatively, she's an amazing sound editor. And Pat Jackson, who years ago inspired me and helped me think that it would be possible.
From a sound perspective, I'm gonna be a bit different, not so much influence, but someone that I've come to know as a friend is Emma Butt, who's another mixer. She's been doing incredible work trying to promote diversity, and you know, it's so hard to do that online, you know, keep up with that. But she's worked with like the Lenny Henry Institute, you know, trying to tackle this, and she's still campaigning. And I give my, you know, hat off to her working on that. And it's something that I really want to try and help out in the next few years, is trying to, you know, help that diversity situation. You know, I think any of us who are involved in post-production professionally, particularly us women and anyone from particular backgrounds, we have the responsibility to make it better. A composer friend of Zoe and I's who passed away who many people wouldn't have heard of, who I was working with was Bildina, who's also a musician called Heir of the Cursed. She did not so much film work, but she did a lot of moving image work, music. I was hopefully was going to be mentoring because she would have been a brilliant sound designer. So that's my dedication, their personal dedication. And we unfortunately lost her in November, but she was such a voice, and I hope that I would believe that she would have left a lot of art behind. I'm hoping that, you know, some, you know, people will pursue that, and even in my own work eventually I would like to try and you know, deliver that in the world a little bit, like, because I think it'd be so tragic for the world to not really have touched on her talent, particularly in Scotland, because as a female voice, let alone a black female voice in Scotland, she really was at the point of, I think she would have been working in the industry in that respect, full time as well.
Then finally, where can people find you? Is there any projects, any socials that you want to plug, promote?
I do exist on LinkedIn, and I do exist on Facebook. So, and just under my own name, Zoe Irvin. So I would say that if anyone wanted to connect with me, those would be the platforms to do it. I hardly ever look at Messenger though, but, you know, eventually I will see it. But yeah, no, and I do exist on Instagram, but basically I only post pictures of dog walks. So that's not that exciting.
I used to put up a lot of stuff, like when I was freelance, and I had an Instagram page, but I'm hoping to maybe, that went absolutely sterile like stone cold last year because I was just so busy, but I'm hoping to start using that as a platform when more this year. I want to try and use that as a sort of blog because I kind of want to show what we're actually doing. And when I say we, I mean myself, like our sound designers, what we're doing, and people can ask questions and stuff. Yeah, I'm on Twitter. That's probably the best place to find me.
So exciting. I'll make sure to link everything down below so people can go and check that stuff out. Well, again, thank you so much for coming on, for giving me your brains. It's been really, really interesting. Thank you. Making It Women in Film is hosted by Malin Evita, produced in collaboration with her and Redeeming Features. Our production supervisor is Ruth Aitken. Research is by Lauren San Miguel. Shania Bethune and Abby Weiss are our production assistants. If you enjoy our show, please remember to subscribe and leave a review. You can also support the show by posting about us on your social media and following us on Instagram at Making It Women in Film. If you have any questions or feedback, DM us or email us at miwif.feedback@gmail.com. For more, visit womeninfilm.co.uk or redeemingfeatures.co.uk. Everything will be linked down in the show notes. Thank you, and we'll see you next Tuesday for another episode of Making It Women in Film.